London Wins, Michael Collins, its director, one of its founders. On stage today, flautists Philippa Davis and Sarah Newbold, oboists Gareth Hulse and Katie Clemo, Michael Collins and Peter Sparks playing clarinets, Dan Jemison and Helen Simons, the bassoonists, Fraser Gordon, contrabassoon, and the four horn players, Richard Watkins, Michael Thompson, Elise Campbell, and Karis Evans. Well, next week here at Cadogan, Prokofiev and Schubert, when Janine Jansen is joined by Zachary Oramo, chief conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. On this occasion, appearing as a violinist, pianist Itamar Golan makes up the trio. That's next Monday at 1 o'clock. For now, from Cadogan Hall, good afternoon.
Petroc Trelawney introduced that chamber prom, which was first broadcast live last Monday, and that next concert, which he just told us about, is at the same time tomorrow. And later in the week, Zachary Oramo will be taking his more familiar position on the rostrum.
On Wednesday night on BBC Radio 3, Zachary Oramo conducts the BBC Symphony Orchestra in an all-English prom, beginning with Vaughan Williams' overture, The Wasps. Violinist Janine Jansen joins the orchestra for the quintessentially English rhapsody, The Lark Ascending. And the season's thread of great 20th century ballet scores continues with Vaughan Williams' Job, before a real rarity, William Alwyn's First Symphony. Join me, Andrew McGregor, at the BBC Proms, live from the Royal Albert Hall, Wednesday night at 6:30, here on BBC Radio 3.
And you may like to know that Vaughan Williams is our Composer of the Week this coming week. A bit of a change to the usual pattern of the programme because of our live morning concerts from the Edinburgh Festival. All this week, Composer of the Week is only on the air in the evening and it's not on Wednesday. So just four editions, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Friday. Donald MacLeod presents the first of them tomorrow evening at 6:30. Back to this Sunday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. Choral Evensong is in an hour's time at 3 o'clock. And then the first of our two live proms today follows when we celebrate the 90th birthday of the conductor Sir Neville Mariner. He'll be conducting the Academy of St Martin in the Fields in a concert from the Royal Albert Hall today at 4 o'clock. It's now approaching 2:02 and time for the Early Music Show.
Hello. My name is Claire Salomon and I'm a multi-instrumentalist and director of the Society of Strange and Ancient Instruments. I've been involved in historically informed performance, or HIP, all my working life. In this programme, I'll be talking to Catherine McIntosh, one of the first string players in this country to explore historically informed playing techniques. I'll be asking her how early music has changed in the last 40 years. And with the help of David McGuinness, director of Concerto Caledonia, and the Norwegian violinist Beata Eicke, director of Baroque Solistine, I'll be taking a look at new and radical ways of approaching historically informed performance. I ask Beata a simple yet challenging question. What is early music?
Before it was, if you play on original instruments, then you're an early music ensemble. It doesn't matter how it sounds, basically. And today it's a very, very difficult question to answer because, I mean, you have early music orchestras, I mean, Baroque orchestras, that have become so mainstream. The whole reason for the early music movement, when that started, was a reaction to the mainstream in the classical music.
So historically informed performance had originally been a reaction to the mainstream, but has now become part of the classical music establishment. I asked Catherine McIntosh just how shocking these radical new sounds produced by instruments in period setup were in the early days of historical performance.
Do you mean shocking in the sense that we made a terrible noise?
Well, I wouldn't like to say, but I imagine they were new sounds anyway.
They were quite new, but they were sort of sounds that we'd somehow had subliminally in our minds because we'd been playing old music on modern instruments for quite some years. And I think many of us felt that they weren't quite comfortable to play, particularly for a string player with the bow. So the first thing that I got was a Baroque bow, and I played with that for 2 or 3 years before I ever got a Baroque violin.
Were you one of the first people to do that, or did you have comrades?
Well, there was the generation that had been sitting at the feet of Arnold Dolmetsch, who came over from Switzerland and set up his workshop in Haslemere with his family, and they were all absolute devotees of research and finding out how to play on these old instruments. But a lot of the people who played with them didn't really have the opportunity or make any particular efforts to bring it out into, as it were, the commercial field. So I think our generation was the first to do that, spearheaded by people like John Beckett and Michael Morrow in Musica Reservata, Roger Norrington's Schütz Choir, and David Munro, who had this wonderful team, including James Bowman and Christopher Hogwood. They were the group that really made waves.
Thank you.
was James Bowman, Charles Brett and the Early Music Consort of London, led by David Munro, in a recording of Rex Carole Johannes Genete by Philippe Royard. These days, a historically informed style of playing permeates performances of 18th century repertoire, even those given by modern instrument orchestras. Early music is well and truly part of the classical music establishment. But like any establishment, it has its rebels. It's the work of those who are taking historically informed performance forward in new and original ways that we'll explore today. Concerto Caledonia has been performing and making CDs since the late 90s. Their work ranges from explorations of 18th century Scottish folk music to ambitious collaborations, and the music they produce is hard to classify. I asked their director, David McGuinness, what his musical influences were.
I think they've been many and various. Lots of pop music growing up in the late 70s. So that whole kind of post-punk thing was my real period. What was it about the whole early music scene that got me? I don't know, I think it was the directness of it, the fact that it was a bit like, oh, this is going to sound ridiculous, but a bit like punk was a reaction to overblown prog rock, so the story goes. Boredom, boredom. Boredom. I think the early music scene in the 60s and 70s was a reaction to the very conservative notions of what classical music was at that time. So there was a similar kind of rebellion motivating it, if you like, a sense that, no, hang on, things don't have to be like this. We could do them like this instead. And I think that appealed to me.
So do you think it's fair to class you as something of a maverick?
No, I don't mean to be a maverick at all. I'm just trying to be interesting. I'm trying to not get bored. Isn't that what all artists do? And if something starts to bore you, you do something else. Well, I think I know the words that I mean. You know me, I'm acting dumb. You know the scene, very humdrum.
Boredom, boredom. Ba-dum-da-dum. There are a couple of albums, Spring Any Day Now in 2003 and Lion in 2007, which I would call compilation albums. Did you have an idea of making something that's very eclectic?
Partly it's that frustrated classical musician thing. I always wanted to play that. In this case, there's a Frank Zappa tune and there's a Buzzcocks song. On one level, that's a bit childish because you think, you know, oh, come on, grow up. But on the other hand, it gets you used to another form of expression within this historical instrument that you're playing. And although that exercise in itself may seem a bit self-indulgent, we know of lots of classical groups that play non-classical repertoire, and sometimes it's great and sometimes it isn't. What the exercise does is it just stretches your range of expression a bit, and then when you go back and play historical material, you've got another resource that you can draw on. If it's appropriate, you can say, oh, hang on, I hadn't realised before, but this piece of music is actually a bit like that. And so what starts off as a rather contrived exercise can actually be very musically useful when you come back to look at historical material again. Apart from that, it's just a really good laugh. You know, I mean, playing the Buzzcocks on Baroque instruments is hysterically funny. It was great.
One Concerto Caledonia project that stands out as unclassifiable is The Revenge of the Folk Singers. I asked David how the idea for the project came about.
Bill Lloyd at Alderburn Music got in touch with us and said, why don't you come here and do a residency? And we had the idea of, as a starting point, having Britain's folk song settings and bringing some traditional singers and some early music people. I wanted to find out not just what musical results we had in common, but what musical processes we had in common, you know, the way that we would improvise, the kind of material that we were dealing with. And it was really exciting, actually. And I also wanted to get away from using classically trained, well, that's a really loaded term, classically trained, isn't it? But singers who spend most of their time in the classical music or even the early music world, because, you know, through no fault of their own, they have to earn a living. And, you know, the way to get a decent fee is to stand in front of a symphony orchestra and sing quite loud. Folk singers tend not to do that because they tend to use a PA instead, and they can be much more intimate. And with a lot of forms of early music, it was never designed to be performed in a big concert hall anyway. You know, it's designed to be played and given in quite an intimate environment. And so that intimacy that a traditional singer can bring, and also the experience and how to tell a story in your own language effectively, bringing that to bear on not just traditional material, but on different forms of early music as well, I think is really exciting.
Sometimes you put quite disparate tunes together and make a set out of them. Can you say something about how you make decisions regarding that?
You do something sometimes for no real reason, and you discover afterwards what the reason was and what it means. Sometimes, you know, you just have a musical idea, you think, oh, that will fit with that. And it seems quite arbitrary, and maybe 6 months later you listen to it and go, oh, there's a connection between that and that, and that's really quite deep, and I didn't realise at the time.
Here's a great example of that. This is My Lord of March Pavan by James Lauder, a French galliard and an English traditional song, The Trees They Do Grow High. I think this is a really interesting and eclectic mix.
They do grow high, and leaves they do grow green. It's cold winter's night that you and I have seen. It's cold winter's endless nights you and I alone have been. Oh, my body boy is young, but he's growing. Father, dearest father, you've done to me more wrong. You've gone and got me married to a boy that is too young. For he is only 16 years and I am 21. Oh, my bonny boy is young, but he's growing. Daughter, dearest daughter, I'll tell you what we'll do. Send your love to college for another year or two. And he will have the finest silk all for to tie his shoe, to let the ladies know that he's married. Men all playing at the ball. And then I spied my own true love, the palest of them all. Oh, my bonny boy is young, but he's growing. For at the age of 16, he was a married man. And at the age of 17, the father to a son. At the age of 18 years, the grass grew over him. Cruel death has put an end to his growing. I'll buy my love some flannel, and I'll make my love a shroud. With every stitch I put in it, the tears come rolling down. With every stitch I put in it, the tears come rolling down. Cruel death has put an end to his growing.
So now we're going to listen to Scott's tune in Can Ye Sew Cushions?
There's a Britain arrangement of Can You Sew Cushions, which is rather nice. And this whole arrangement just spontaneously happened in rehearsals. We all sat around in a circle and Mary sang it to us. And the arrangement just kind of happened. And after we'd gone through it once, I turned to Bill Taylor, who's playing the clarsach, and sort of went, which is a tune from the Jane Pickering manuscript, which, you know, we both knew. And he said, oh, yeah, that'll fit, and promptly played it. And they just sat together really nicely. And it's lovely when that happens, when you've got things which we only know because they have survived in manuscript form and now they're part of an oral tradition again. You know, you can sing it to someone and go, oh, let's play this, and it happens. I think that's really lovely. It's like sort of reconstructing an oral tradition from the remnants that were once left behind.
Sing Balalulo when the band greets.
That was a Scots tune and Can Ye Sew Cushions, performed by Concerto Caledonia, directed by David McGuinness. I've been involved in several Concerto Caledonia projects, and David's open-minded and exploratory approach to historically informed performance has inspired many aspects of my own work with the Society of Strange and Ancient Instruments. For us, historical information is a source of inspiration rather than a set of instructions. Social context and performance values associated with the old music we play are as important to us as the actual dots on the page. The aim is to share an experience between ourselves and with our audience, and for that experience to feel relevant and meaningful. Here's Rest Sweet Nymphs by Francis Pilkington, followed by Moy Linda, a Galliard by Anthony Holborn.
Rest Sweet Nymphs, let golden sleep charm your star-brighter eyes, whilst my lute of watchdog says your bliss, ascend them by your wishes. Although they be not mine. Thus, dear damsels, I do give good night, and so I'm gone. With your heart's desires, long live still joy and
that was Rest Sweet Nymphs by Francis Pilkington, followed by Moylinda by Anthony Holborn, played by my group, the Society of Strange and Ancient Instruments. The instrumental lineup included viola bastarda, nickel harper, dulcian and cornet, and the unusual introduction was inspired by a jamming session over the bass line. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Claire Salomon. Baroque Solistin, an early music group led by Norwegian violinist Beate Eicke, was established in 2005. They're as comfortable with conventional presentations of Baroque repertoire as they are with adventurous crossover projects. One of Beate's guiding principles is not to be limited by boundaries and preconceptions. the communication between audience and performer always takes priority. I asked Beata if the group's slogan, "It's just old pop music," applies to all the music that they play.
No, of course not. If you're doing a big mass at the church, you can't just call it old pop music. It's really not trying to be accurate about everything that we do. But it's, on the other hand, trying to break with some of these preconceptions or move some boundaries that we've been living with as classical musicians or as early music musicians, that everything has to be taken so seriously and being so, well, so important all the time. And there's all this fantastic music going in all different directions. And some of this music is really just popular tunes.
There are some great examples of this in Baroque Solistine's Alehouse programme, which I was lucky enough to see a few weeks ago. It's a riot. There's wild dancing, raucous folk tunes, heart-wrenching ballads, even a Slovakian plaint, and no sheet music anywhere to be seen. The audience is frequently invaded by performers and the whole thing is oiled by a steady stream of alcohol.
What I was planning to do was to make a concert with the story of beer. When all the theatres were closed and Cromwell, he was the Puritan who closed everything and didn't allow any music to be played anywhere. And so people went to the pubs and they started to play. And then there are all these fantastic collections and references to these early music houses that developed into big concert halls after a while. Slightly an accident, really. But then, you know, then you create this sort of room, which is called an alehouse. You have a fantastic backdrop or a setting, and then you can put almost anything into it. You can put a lot of beer into it. You can put many anecdotes into it. And you can go and discover all these fantastic folk tunes and put them together, rearrange them, improvise on them, have fun on it. The aim is that no alehouse concert should be the same.
Beata's latest CD is called The Art of Melancholy. It was a very personal project. I asked him why and how he put it together.
I've been collecting this bank of music that is meaningful to me, that has had this special effect that you really just think the hair on your back is standing up and you just feel this extreme warmth when you're playing. And it could be either playing a five-part concert or it could be old Norwegian folk melodies that I've known for many, many years, or songs that I've heard, or even people that I've met that have a way of playing or singing that really just, you know, makes time stand still for me. And then my father got sick, and all these melodies have some sort of sadness to them or melancholic feel. I invited all these fantastic people out in the forest somewhere close to Trondheim in Norway. And we just stay there and we cook together. We stay there together and we recorded a lot of songs. There was nobody saying, "We have now bar two, let's move on to bar three." All these things that you do normally in the recording business, especially classical music, where every note has to be perfect.
Soon.
That was John Dowland's Susanna Galliard, played by Baroque Solistin. And before that, we heard them playing a traditional Norwegian lullaby. Yves Agilini, led by Robert Hollingworth, is one of the most adventurous vocal groups in the UK. It has a core repertoire of Renaissance and contemporary music, which is often presented in groundbreaking ways. Beata told me about his experience of working with the group.
Robert is such an inspiration to work with. He's opened my mind a lot to, for instance, this thing about using space, taking whatever space you come to and then looking what's the possibilities and how can we do it just slightly different. It's always very classy what he does, I think very tasteful. And he's always been surrounded by fantastic singers.
Yves Agilini are renowned for their highly original approach to presenting early music, and they have a string of acclaimed projects behind them. These include The Full Monteverdi, a dramatisation of Monteverdi's fourth book of madrigals, where the audience sit amongst the singers, breaking the fundamental concert hall convention of separating audience and performers. The Full Monteverdi offered a uniquely physical, voyeuristic experience.
Thank you.
That was I Fagiolini, directed by Robert Hollingworth, singing Luci Serene e Chiari from Monteverdi's fourth book of madrigals. Another early music group that has challenged the status quo is the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, otherwise known as the OAE. Their strapline states that not all orchestras are the same. Their management structure and their approach to reaching their audience is certainly different from most other period instrument orchestras. They talk about throwing out the rule book and how playing on period-specific instruments is just one element of their quest for authenticity. Catherine McIntosh was there at the beginning and was one of the orchestra's leaders for 20 years.
The main thing that we really wanted when we set up the orchestra is that we weren't going to limit ourselves to playing in any one style. Of course, we brought our own individual styles. We'd all been playing by this time for, well, a good 15, 20 years on original instruments.
And the orchestra must have felt very empowered because they were the people deciding who was going to direct them. I mean, that's an incredible thing when you look at it in the context of classical
change,
music.
Big change, yes.
Here is the last movement of the Viola d'Amore Concerto in D by Vivaldi, played by the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment and directed by the soloist Catherine McIntosh.
Thank you.
That was the last movement of the Viola d'Amore Concerto in D by Vivaldi, played by the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment and directed by the soloist, Catherine McIntosh. The Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment have devised a concert series called The Night Shift. In these performances, they present classical music free of the usual concert hall conventions.
That was an absolute genius idea. That is a way of reaching out in a very informal concert situation to young people. It's quite riotous at the ends of concerts. There's a lot of sort of whistling and clapping, and people don't necessarily wait until the end of a piece. You know, they might clap in the middle of a movement if they think somebody's done a great cadenza or something.
Well, that sounds great. That sounds completely authentic.
Very 18th century, yes. That is really trying to recreate the spontaneity of performing.
I was lucky enough to be among generations of string players who were taught by Catherine McIntosh and inspired by her generous and open-minded approach to historically informed performance. Julia Bishop was another of her students and is a core member of Red Priest, a group which has found new and exciting ways to present Baroque music. They've incorporated video and lighting into some of their shows. They play by heart and have gained a huge following for their flamboyant performances. Here they are, playing an arrangement of two airs from Scylla et Glaucus by Jean-Marie Leclerc. Two airs from Scylla et Glaucus by Jean-Marie Leclerc, arranged and performed by Red Priest. The arrangement of Renaissance and Baroque music is central to the practice of most of the groups mentioned in this programme. David McGuinness told me why he likes to approach old music in this way.
Rather than having all the instrumentation always decided by historical research, if you like, there's another side to making music, which is basically forming a band of really good musicians and then finding repertoire for them to do. I was always very impressed with Jordi Savall's work, the early work with Hesperion 20 in particular, because he unashamedly said, this is 20th century music, and he just put this band of amazing musicians together and then found repertoire for them to do. And it always sounded like them. He wasn't trying to reconstruct some historical event, because I think that's really quite an uninteresting way of looking at history. You know, what happened? That's the least interesting bit about history. It's why it happened and what it meant.
As we heard at the beginning of the programme, Catherine McIntosh's career started with explorations of medieval and Renaissance music with David Munro and Christopher Hogwood. She went on to lead the Academy of Ancient Music and the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, and she's still inspiring new generations of historically informed performance students. What does she think the future for early music holds?
Well, I don't think it is early music anymore. I think it's just music. Early music is now just what we wanted it to be when we started playing it, which was to show people that it's music just the same as any other music. And if people find that it sounds better on old instruments, which is what we found, then good, let them play it on old instruments.
Catherine McIntosh ending today's Early Music Show. It was presented by Claire Salomon and produced in Salford by Nick Holmes. On next week's programme, the harpsichordist Sophie Yates visits the Royal Academy of Music here in London to explore Rameau's mastery of dance music in his works for the theatre. That's at the same time, 2 o'clock next Sunday afternoon. And in the meantime, you may like to know that Jordi Savall and Hesperion 21 will be among Max Reinhardt's guests when he presents Late Junction live from Edinburgh, the first of three programmes this week. That's on Tuesday night here on BBC Radio 3 at 11 o'clock. Back to the Sunday afternoon, and Choral Evensong is next after this.
The National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain makes its annual visit to the Proms with a fiery programme of 20th century orchestral showpieces conducted by Edward Gardner. A Russian first half opens with Stravinsky's Petrushka, a ballet that brims with audacious energy. And the verve continues with Prokofiev's youthful first piano concerto, led by BBC Radio 3 new generation artist Louis Schwitzgebel. Lutosławski's Concerto for Orchestra closes the evening. Join me, Penny Gore, live from the Royal Albert Hall tonight at 7:45 here on BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms.
And before that, the first of today's live proms celebrates Sir Neville Mariner's 90th birthday. That's in an hour at 4 o'clock. Before that, on BBC Radio 3, Choral Evening Prayer, which was first broadcast last Wednesday, the Feast of the Transfiguration, from Buckfast Abbey in Devon during the 2014 Exon Singers Summer Festival. Much of the music comes from the Renaissance period. The first reading is followed by an anthem by the Italian composer Tiburtio Masaino, Christus Jesus Splendor Patris, Jesus Christ Radiance of the Father, and the Magnificat on the fourth tone is by Palestrina. The Psalms include a setting of Psalm 121, I Will Lift Up Mine Eyes Unto the Hills, by Robin Holloway. And receiving its first performance in this service is Toby Young's setting of the Lord's Prayer. That's followed by Josquin Desprez's motet Ave Maria. Opening the service now, another work by Robin Holloway, an introit for Transfiguration, which is also receiving its first performance. Splendour of the Father's glory, charity unbounded, lavish on us at this time the fullness of your love.
Welcome to Choral Evening Prayer from Buckfast Abbey in Devon, as we celebrate the wonderful feast of the Transfiguration of our Lord. Falling more often than not on a weekday, this glorious festival is easily overlooked. And yet, it has so much to say that is of huge significance in the Gospel story. It is a foretaste of our Lord's resurrection and a revelation of the true identity of the person with whom those three disciples were spending their time treading the streets and lanes of Galilee. To travel to Buckfast Abbey, for whatever reason, to a Benedictine community of monks famed for their hospitality and awareness of the divine, is to come to a place of vision and holiness. Refreshed by this breathtaking building, built for worship, and only recently restored, is to have fellowship with the divine. The Apostle Paul writes, "God has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of his glory in the face of Jesus Christ."
O Lord, open thou our lips, and our mouths shall show forth thy praise. O God, make speed to save us. O Lord, increase to help us. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Ghost. As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. Praise be the Lord. The Lord's name be praised.
O vision blessed of heavenly light, we